Hello. So here we are at what I think of as a turning point in this course, also a turning point in the history of my society and perhaps of the human race altogether. I'm speaking on Monday while the last hours of the political campaigning are going on, and the first hours of the post-electoral maneuvering are already happening. By the time we're next together, I suppose that everything will be a little more known than it is now. But I believe that the election is the beginning rather than the end of the narrative of tension we are about to live through. Vladimir Ilyich Lenin says that there are decades when nothing happens and weeks when decades happen. And next week, maybe the week after that, are likely to be of that kind. It would be good in that sense if we could drop all other subjects and go directly to where I want this course to end, with matters of the electronic democracy and the information structures of the contest for political power in the age of the net. But it is unfortunately the case that if we are to explain the contemporary, we have to unearth its structures of being and its possibilities and the sources of its authority and chaos in a systematic way. Too much around us is description of the net and its consequences all the time without any fundamental commitments in the analysis of these pieces, their anatomy, their physiology, and their interpreted meaning. So I have to leave for a period in which we may hope the dust has somewhat settled later in the month of November and early in December to come to the question of electronic democracy. And in between is the matter to which we are now turning to understand the rights of privacy carefully, to begin where we would want the policy analysis to begin, that is, with the substantive rights of people, not the network, not the data, but the people, as we learn whether, as on another day in the warmer weather of 1863, we wondered also whether government of the people, by the people, for the people might come to perish from the earth. So, as I believe we need to turn this conversation from the anatomy and physiology of the net we didn't want to the question of the rights of the people in their privacies, let me take the opportunity to sum up what I think we've so far said. As a result of changes brought about by the Cold War, by the presence of nuclear weapons, and by the evolution of the American national security state in the 1970s, American government and the research institutions of American society began to evolve the nervous system of a species-wide interconnection for the human race that at the time was thought of only as a method for securing robust political and military command and control under the conditions of possible nuclear war. The ARPANET, the Defense Advanced Research Product Agency's version of the net that could ultimately connect all computers, regardless of their architectures and hardware designs and software structures, the ARPANET became the internet and a form of anatomy for the future species-wide nervous system was standardized in the petri dish of Cold War confrontation. That network consisted of peers, non-hierarchically connected in a structure which layered the simple distribution of packets, which might be made for any purpose out of anything, but which had a source address and a destination address in the network, and which indicated how they were to be regarded with respect to quality of service or swiftness of movement. The result of which, when there were a proliferation of other kinds of networks throughout society, as hardware went from mainframes to heterogeneous networks of mainframes and mini computers to personal computers to portable devices, the network changed its piping many times over from different forms of physical carriage to different forms of electromagnetic carriage. The packet switch network came to absorb the previous forms of circuit switch network embodied by telephone systems. The result of which was, over the course of 50 years, the evolution of a single flexible network design still bearing most of the original decisions made by its architects in the military research infrastructure of the United States in the 1970s, but immensely sophisticated in all the proliferation around those simple designs as intended. And this is the anatomical structure of the network now embracing humanity, which in the near term will reach every growing and changing brain and mind on Earth from birth to death, from the cradle to the grave. This network of cells that knows how to interoperate everything and to create a single structure for the distribution across the species of every form of information, mis and pro and ob and so on. This form of anatomy has a physiology which is defined by software. How things operate within this nervous system depends upon the behavior of the switches which control who gets what, when, how, on what terms, for how long, and with what conditions or reciprocities required. On top of this physiology is the economy of everything that came to be digital, that is, that came to have zero marginal cost of copying and transmission, which turned out to be pretty much all the cultural possession of the human race, its science, its art, its music, its exchange information, its authenticated records, its history, its journalism, its spying, propaganda, lying, and all that dancing. This structure of a system of interconnected neural operations that spans the globe and can reach anyone with anything has no defined social purpose. It can be used to allow every brain on Earth to learn anything the mind within it wants at any time, anywhere, regardless of the ability to pay or any government attitude. It can also be used to perfect surveillance-based despotism. It is the source of the production mode that Shoshana Zuboff called surveillance capitalism, that sequence of operations leading from raw material to profit that combines both the labor of doing human behavior and being watched while doing it and the capital of the surveilling machinery. These structures, the neuroanatomy of the globe-spanning neural structure that combines itself around humanity, the physiology of a network based on software which can be written by human beings and executed by machines, and which can give that network any local or global properties that human beings can conceive. The nature of the zero marginal cost systems for the production and distribution of all culture in digitized form, and the evolution of a structure of production and ownership which can be called surveillance capitalism in one guise or perfected despotism in another. All of those pieces together combine to give us now the form of networked human life which you take for granted, and which is the contingent, path-dependent outcome of the interplay of these forces I have named. Above the layer of the physiology of the switches, the network can be thought of as a hierarchy of services. You get from somewhere the services that through the handset or laptop or other form of switch closest to your eyeball and your eardrum supports your life. Email and other forms of messaging between individuals, calendaring and the other tools of collaboration, which are ethno-methodologies now, ways of living just as important as how you walk down the street without bumping into people, or how you use a knife and fork so as to assume the role in one or another society of civilized person. The services allow you to know where you are going, provide you with mapping whether you are walking, running, bicycling, driving, or flying, offer you a sense of where you are in the world at any given moment, statistically, photographically, cartographically, in the economics of your trade, your wallet contents, your investment funds, everything available on the tablet, phone, laptop, other thing in front of you, gadget, device, all the time. But this device is also probably spying on you, collecting your behavior for other people's or other computers' delectation, buzzing, beeping, squawking, blinking, giving you something with which to engage, and following the movement of your eyeballs and your blood pressure and everything else as you do. At the center of this network now, barely half a decade old, sits that coagulation of all the behavior data of billions of human beings collected trillions of times. All this information, not only about each particular human individual and what makes her swipe, punch, click, tap, or otherwise behave, what makes her heart run faster, what makes her step more bouncy, what presses her down, what makes her stay in bed, all that information about each and every him, her, they, and other, as well as a kind of view over the whole, an understanding of how billions of people are behaving differently from day to day, and watching the patterns of dissipation and dispersion and concentration and coagulation of behavior across the entirety of the species. A view of the very largest phenomena of human life, correlated to perfect meteorological data so far as there is a weather station anywhere, and every piece of mapping and the secrets of the governments and all of it sitting in the center whirl of this entity we created that knows about human beings both the largest of the large and the smallest of the small, this thing that eats behavior in order to increase its grasp and secretes hormones that create more clicking, swiping, tapping, buzzing, beeping, walking, running, and etc. This parasite with the mind of God, which grew up in the middle of this anatomy, tumor-like, more rapidly than human beings could understand its onset, and which is now an independent force, not just to be reckoned with, but to be survived, overcome, or surrendered to. And this, as my friend Dan Gere says, this is the last generation in which the human race gets a choice. That's where we've been, in a nutshell, if you like, in, you know, 15 minutes, 42 seconds of the vocabulary we have been building together. I've tried to show how the services that we use grew into the structure which holds us to the network. The habituations of human culture that make it hard for us to imagine, most of you at any rate, not having a smart-ass phone around you all the time and being connected to the parasite through all the services it offers you. But the services themselves can be analytically removed from that particular geometric configuration. It's not the need for the services that makes the parasite with the mind of God and sustains it. It's not the need for the services that makes Xinjiang a place of perfected despotism. It's the way the services are operated within a network which is infinitely flexible and completely physiologically plastic, and which can respond to the software that makes it by offering those services in any of a trillion different forms. You don't need centralized email to have email. You might need centralized search until federated search is a form of computer program that we have perfected in its time. But you don't need centralized search to be connected to an advertising platform which you're constantly giving behavior data to, which is constantly monetizing your use of your own device to go your own way in order to build immense wealth for the parasite's handmaids in Mountain View or Beijing or wherever. The structure of the services is controlled, as Shoshana says, in a market. And that market is affected by the underlying political economy of surveillance capitalism. And so everybody wants to know how to regulate that market, just as they want to understand how to regulate the industries, without first developing for themselves a clear understanding of the anatomy, the physiology, the meaning in discipline and movement of the physiology, the structure of the services, therefore the structure of the market for the services, therefore the place at which law, science, technology, and politics can join to create some operable vision of human destiny, so that indeed whatever choice the human race wants to make, it actually gets it done. Into that structure, then, we have everything so far but a clear understanding of what it is that the human being rights are, the underlying commitment that we have made to ourselves, to humans, collectively and individually, that they are whatever it is that it means to be in charge of their lives, that they govern themselves. that they are therefore free people. Not cogs in the parasite's wheel, not mere units to be counted and displaced by the vanguard party of the people, not the mere popular will dissolved into individual meat bags that can be punctured as necessary by the ritualized violence of populist regime. People, ends in themselves, possessed of the ability to learn and to teach and to feel pain and joy for one another, and to make the choices which collectively compose the society of each, tending to all, for the good of each, and for the good of all. But this vision of the society based on rights and the human individual's moral agency and power as well as claim to self-government, this in itself requires us to win back from the parasite and from the network the definition and control of the human value system, which is both undermined in its previous integrity and replaced to a large extent by fine-spun structures of what we now recognize to be the excrement of the parasite, the misinformation, the purely, if it clicks, it wiggins kind of structure of information distribution, the virality of the excrement of the parasite. Which means that if we are to save the image of ourselves from what we've done, we need to concentrate for the moment at the most basic, precise level on what it is we are describing as the human being's right, not in the high-flown language of our declarations, but in the operant language of our network, of our switches and our pipes. And this then brings us to what it is we mean by privacy. In a world of services where we ask one another through computers, do you have this? Yes, I have that. May I have it? Yes, here it is. Whether the here it is about your calendar, your email, your location, the nearest pizza parlor, information about the weather tomorrow, whatever it is, the service of providing in response to requests, which is all digital services at the level we now wish to address them. All those services, all the communications, all the messages passing back and forth, which now constitute the way in which we live our lives connected to that nervous system that didn't used to be there, which when I was a child learning how to think about making it, it still had never been seen by anyone. This thing of yesterday, which has transformed the nature of what it means to be alive, this system of services we can describe as either possessing or lacking, from the individual human being's point of view, certain properties. Without knowing it, when we use the word privacy, we're talking about a trio of those properties. We don't take privacy apart. We don't analyze it. We compound it. And so we throw around this word privacy without knowing exactly what it is that we are talking about, and if we are to define the rights we have in such a way as to understand our future within this network we have wrapped around ourselves, we need to be more precise. Privacy, therefore, I will say, is actually three different properties of our life around those digital communications. The first property is secrecy. a service or a message is secret, when the content passing between the requester and the provider, the recipient and the sender, the two parties in a dialogue, whatever it may be, when the content of those communications is unknown to anyone except the parties communicating themselves. A secret communication has content known only to the parties communicating. The next property that is contained within privacy is anonymity. A service or a series of messages is anonymous if the identities of the provider and recipient, the sender and the getter, the parties in a dialogue, the members of a group, whatever it may be, if the identities of the parties communicating are unknown, even when the content of the communications is not unknown. Anonymous communications or services conceal their endpoints, even when the content being exchanged is known to anyone who cares. Autonomy is the third component of privacy. Autonomy is the human being's ability to make and effect life decisions without the consequences of violations of secrecy or anonymity. Autonomy, then, is that part of the series of properties we call privacy. Autonomy is that property which connects the processes of the messages or services in the nervous system that joins us. Technical structures, which either permit the viewing of endpoints but obscure the nature of the messages being passed, or which allow the nature of messages being passed to be visible while obscuring the points engaged in communication. Whatever those technical processes may be, autonomy is the property of privacy that connects that to the freedom of the human being and the avoidance of coercion and control by parties in possession of technical leverage. This, then, these three components, secrecy, anonymity, and autonomy, are the alphabet of privacy. And hereafter in this course, and I hope in other elements or aspects of fora in your life, when you or I or both of us or all the race together are trying to think about issues of privacy, we will always begin by asking to which extents proportionately we're talking about secrecy and anonymity and autonomy. And knowing at any given moment what we mean by the word privacy will help us to get to answers that might otherwise seem to be merely matters of taste or political dispute. I shan't today try to evolve a full explanation of each of these components, but it is important to begin by showing the ways in which the componentry of privacy emerges from its fundamental root in secrecy. This is the way that privacy is most often used in the language of ordinary social and life description. We are private when we are secret, when we are behind closed doors, when we are keeping our voices down, when we are whispering in the center of a field late at night in order to avoid being overheard by family and friends at the communal kitchen, etc., etc. Privacy is, in our ordinary intuitive judgment, secured by secrecy, and this is literally right. It is secrecy which provides security to privacy. Privacy, whatever we mean by it, whether we are talking about anonymity only or in combination with autonomy, privacy's guarantee, its durability, is always the outcome of some system of secrecy. The ability to obscure information is what ultimately makes every other form of privacy, whatever we mean in the tridentarian view of its nature, whatever we mean by privacy, it lasts only because keeping secrets is possible. In this sense, large-scale behavior collection is an attempt to eliminate secrecy. We may think, in any given context, that we are keeping a secret, and therefore something is private. But one of the great difficulties that we face in understanding this area of social life in the conditions of technology we experience now is that a secret is not necessarily a piece of information nobody knows. A secret may, in the end, actually be a piece of information that nobody, no matter how much information she already possesses, can guess. I had an employee once upon a time whose goal it was in life, I don't think it was his only goal, but it was way too much his operant goal on any given day, whose goal it was in life to conceal his social security number. He had, after all, the law of the society on his side. A social security number is, in the narrowest and most specific sense of law, a secret. You are not compelled to give it to people. Only voluntarily may you disclose your social security number, but as you know, you are voluntarily disclosing your social security number all the time to all sorts of people, whatever their reasons or excuses may be. He did not. I have to say that as a small business employer, this is a drag. An employee who wants to exercise his full right to keep his social security number to himself becomes a cost to the business of a significant kind. Proxy numbers will help you with respect to some kinds of activity, but there are other things that you will face exterior compulsion about, simply because people won't do business with you if you don't reveal the social security numbers of your relevant employees. But out of respect for the principle that was being carried to its logical extreme, I did everything I could for almost half a decade to make good on the principle that this person did not need to disclose his social security number. And then one day, half a decade into our relationship of employment, I walked in and I said, "Well, I have to tell you, so this is, we're done now, it's over. Google knows your social security number." And he looked up at me with genuine outrage, and he said, "How could they possibly? I've never given it to anybody except my wife. Nobody else knows my social security number." And I said, "Yeah. But Google knows the social security number of everybody else born in Baltimore the year you were born. Yours is the other one. The problem is that past a certain point, the information we consider to be not known, to be secret, is merely information pointed to or inferable from or synthesized out of other information which is not a secret and which in a world of comprehensive collection of behavior and invasion of privacy, we can reasonably expect to be in the possession of someone who is not in on the secret. Whether it's a researcher in the Netherlands who happens to be good at guessing the password on Donald Trump's Twitter account, or whether, as I say, it is a party in possession of so much information that the information previously kept secret is inferable directly from the body of everything else, or whether it is in the intermediate range, it's important to understand that a secret is information which might be guessed but isn't directly knowable. And that in the world in which we live now, the power of secrecy to protect privacy is a statistical proportion of what we think we mean when we say something is a secret. At any given moment, about any given piece of information in the world, the probability of its secrecy is directly related to the degree to which it can be inferred from other information that some party or other is motivated to collect. And this is why all rights of privacy are relative, not merely because as some matter of legal theory we think it ought to be that way, but because there isn't any alternative to regarding secrecy as relative, and all privacy depends for its security on secrecy, and all privacy is therefore relative. And just about the only behavior that can be fully controlled is government behavior in a state ruled by law. We love, as I pointed out once upon a time in a piece you may have read, I know that I assigned it, but that doesn't mean that you read it, we love to spy on one another. The curiosity of children is the most powerful social force that exists, but the desire of individual human beings to spy on and to surveil and thereby, in one sense or another, to control the other people around them, that's about as strong a social force as anything other than the curiosity of children can be categorized as being. The desire of sexual partners to spy on one another in order to maintain information about their fidelity or infidelity in current version, that may be attributed in some evolutionary psychological way to the question of security, of belief in the legitimacy of one's offspring, but I actually think that's all just a bunch of baloney dredged up by, you know, evolutionary psychologists who really, I mean, you know, give me a break. Human beings' love of spying on one another is part of the basal anatomy out of which the parasite with the mind of God tumorically evolved. One of the uses of the platforms, after all, which spy on everybody all the time, is to give little bits of spying on other people away to keep you engaged. Part of the process by which the parasite forces us ever longer hours spent scrolling over its material is the surveillance aspect of the thing. I needn't tell you that in the world's more misogynist, no, not more misogynist, more differently and more harshly misogynist societies, Facebook is an excellent tool for keeping track of the behavior of one's nieces and the other girls of the village and what have you. Social discipline results not just from the spying done by the platforms themselves, by the logic of surveillance capitalism, But by the logic of the human compulsion to surveillance, which lies underneath the capitalism, as the love of money is the root of all evil in the Roman proverb. So the desire to spy becomes in itself a psychological rationale for the evolution of structures of service rendition which are potentially non-secret. And it's that sense of potentially non-secret that something which people might rely upon as trustworthy to keep their secrets, like their phone, is actually capable of being hacked, which we should really call cracked. The hackers don't want to hack into people's phones. That's what crackers do. They crack into safes. But whatever you want to call that activity, the activity of turning that which some people trust into that which helps you spy, that's a very desirable property. We need to think of that as the social opposite of the desire for secrecy. And thus we understand that the right of privacy, which depends in substantial measure for its security on the component we call secrecy, is itself constantly at war throughout the totality of human experience with the depth of the alternate human motive to spy. Every form of social life then involves forms of tradecraft. But the tradecraft of the digital network is of a technical kind that's different from the world of other forms of trying to improve one's secrecy against the inevitable corrosive force of the human love of spying. From the point of view of that level of operationalism which causes us to see secrecy as the ability to keep the contents of messages obscure while in the process of transmission and at rest before and afterwards, when we think of secrecy as the ability to obscure particular digital messages, we are in the end talking about a mathematical activity. Secrecy in the world of digital privacy implies encryption, which is the word we use for making mathematical changes to the content of a message, turning it from one number into another number, such that only a party having special power or entitlement can restore the original message by a symmetrical or at least bracketing mathematical activity. So, once upon a time, in the 1970s, when all of this was new and so was the sexual revolution that resulted from the attainment by women of power over reproduction through functional contraception. Once upon a time in the 1970s, there was a movie about consensual intermarital sexual involvement called Bob and Carol and Ted Nowlis. And while the particular form of spouse swapping that movie supposedly involved, it was, you know, a little cultural relic of its era, the names stuck. And the cryptographers, that is to say the mathematicians and engineers who work on encryption, adopted these couples. And so ever since, in our working papers and literature of encryption, we meet Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice exchanging secret messages in various contexts. So let us say then that from the point of view of the fundamental component of digital privacy, that is secrecy, which in our world means encryption, when Bob wants to send a secret message to Alice, the general process since the beginning of our recorded cultures about this is that Bob and Carol have a secret which they exchange in advance, a key to the lock on their communications. Perhaps it's a code book in which every word they might want to exchange is correspondingly paired with some innocent word, and they can communicate in code by exchanging words which only the possessor of the code book dictionary can turn back into the original message. Or, like Julius Caesar famously in the invention of the Caesar cipher, they can simply count four letters forward in the alphabet from every letter in every word and turn every A into a D and every B into an E and so on. Or in some other more complicated geometrical or symbolic transformation, they can encipher their communications one to another, but always there needs to be a shared secret, which implies that Bob and Carol must have been at some point in the privacy, the secrecy of an opportunity to exchange a message, which, if overheard or intercepted, would bring the whole thing down, but which, if successfully passed, allows covert communication to occur in future. At least in theory, a shared secret can be used to create perfectly secure communication thereafter. This occurs if what you exchange is a very large amount of key material corresponding to what in the cryptography of the Cold War we call the one-time pad. If there is a very large secret exchange between two parties, those bits of that on that one-time pad can be used to provide completely secure communication thereafter. Only the two parties who possess the only two existing in the world copies of the one-time pad would know what bits to exclusive or with the bits of the message being sent to them, and therefore a bit stream of perfect secrecy could be exchanged between them as long as there are only two copies of the one-time pad and each of the parties has one and nobody else has anything. In theory, we can thus achieve perfect secrecy, but in fact, the administrability problem of a shared secret only increases as the secret itself grows larger or more complex. The result of which is that, by and large, the world hankered through the Second World War and substantially afterward for some form of mathematical transformation that could be applied to messages that would allow people to exchange messages in secrecy without a preceding shared secret in their joint possession. It sounds as though it must be impossible, but it isn't. Contemporary digital encryption allows us to establish, for example, a secure connection to a website that we have never visited before. It allows parties who have no previous contact with one another to establish secure communication for the purpose of contracting by allowing the parties to know that their counterparty's signature is authentic by checking it against the levels of trust placed in that signature by other people the counterparty knows. It allows them to exchange documents in certainty that the document arriving with a counterparty signature on it has not been modified in transit, that it is the document that was issued by the party whose identity can be authenticated. All of this can occur between parties with no prior connection, which means that secure digital payment systems are possible. in which parties who are strangers can be sure that payment tokens they receive from newly met or acquainted or contracted parties are valid, that the party offering them is, in the view of authorities or trust partners that the recipient trusts who they say they are, and that these tokens represent funds which have not been spent before, which are valid current coin. All of this can be done because beginning in the mid-1970s, just about the same time that the network came into existence as the ARPANET, mathematical progress allowed a vision of a way for secure communication to occur without previous exchange of shared secrets. The three cryptographers who figured out how that could happen, Ron Rivest, Adi Shamir, and Joseph Edelman, RSA, Rivest, Shamir, and Edelman, as their algorithms and basic mathematics came to be known. The three cryptographers who came to that conclusion, along with other mathematicians and cryptographers, Whitfield Diffie, the most important of them, working on similar but not identical mathematics, made in the course of the mid-1970s the necessary breakthrough. I recognize that the discussion of elegant mathematics in a law school classroom is sort of like the discussion of, elegant music in a course on engineering for those without functional hearing. No doubt that numeracy among law students is no worse than it was when I was in law school, and in some law schools at some times numeracy is substantially better, but still when one talks about math in law school, one has to use some language other than math, which is regrettable. In the podcast form, of course, we would never be speaking math anyway. So I will here do the dancing about mathematics involved in describing rather than explaining how the RSA and equivalent mathematics of public key encryption work. But let's begin with a simple physical version. In the wall of the bank branch that you walk by every day, there is a night deposit box on the wall of the bank. That is an little armored spot with an external key that opens a drum or a door on the face of the building. This allows businesses that work at night or close at night to deposit their receipts overnight in the bank. The party having control of the business receipts brings the bag of cash and checks and what have you to the bank and opens the door and drops the deposit in, and then the deposit drops down a chute from where the next person to open the outside bank on the door can't reach it, but it can be opened from the inside of the bank next day by the receiving clerk who has the key to the inside door of this shared space. Before there was an ATM, this was, of course, the only form of locked exchange box in the bank. Now, the ATM machine itself is yet another with a digital lock on it. You put in a card, you type in a PIN, that's a thing you have, plus a thing you know. That's two-factor authentication, and the device opens and will allow you to put in checks or to remove cash, but only to the extent that you are authorized and everything else remains in a secure back of the machine. Public key encryption does for digital information what those two forms of physical access portal do at the bank. There's a public key, which opens the public side of the exchange, and there's a private key, which opens the private side of the exchange. If I wish, as Bob, to send Carol a secret message, I can look up Carol's public key. With her public key, I can perform a mathematical change to the message I am sending so that only the person in possession of Carol's private key, who should be Carol, is able to read it. The public key that Carol uses can be published in a directory of public keys. Anybody may have it. Anybody who wishes to send Carol a secret can encrypt the message using the public key. Only Carol, so long as she is careful to remain in control of her private key, only Carol can read any of those messages. Because only Carol's private key will allow the restoration of the original message from the ciphertext. The basic mathematics, if we are now to discuss how a private and a public key can exist, would look like this. I take two very large prime numbers, numbers that have 100 digits each, and I multiply them together, those two prime numbers. I will now have a composite number, 200 digits long, which has only two factors, the two prime numbers from which I started. Let us think of the public key as that new 200-digit composite number. The private key will be the two prime numbers from which it was created. If an algorithm, if a function, a mathematical entity is available which takes a message, M, and turns it into some completely different message, M prime, the encrypted version of message M, in such a way that if we had the two original prime numbers from which that composite key was created, we could turn M prime back to M, we would have a one-way system of public key encryption in which any message could be sent by anybody possessing the key, public key, but which could only be read by someone who either A, already possessed the private keys, or who could factor 200-digit prime numbers. So long as the mathematics of factoring large numbers is tractable by computer, but only in proportion to the square of the length of the number, we can always just make the key longer to defeat an attacker whose computers can factor n-digit numbers in finite time. And this is essentially the structure of secrecy created by the RSA and Diffie-Hellman forms of public key encryption. A mathematical property like primeness and the difficulty of factoring large numbers, a mathematical one-wayness in the structure of how numbers work. It's easy to do X and hard or very hard or best yet near impossible in finite time to do the reverse of X. Such operations, with a few additional gimmicks that we don't need to think about right now, such operations provide for a public key encryption system in which you publish how to encrypt and you keep secret how to decrypt. Such a system provides high quality, working, socially available encryption among strangers who do not need previously to have exchanged a code book or a cipher plan. This is essentially the way your basic encryption works between your browser and so-called secure websites using the HTTPS protocol. A form of such encryption, transport layer encryption, is used to make the network connection between your browser and the website one which is opportunistically encrypted. The two parties begin an encryption conversation based on the published key of the website, signed by someone else like VeriSign to say, yes, you should trust that this is Citibank's public key being handed to you because we, VeriSign, have signed it, a stage we'll come back to in just a moment. And your browser says, okay, well, if you're Citibank, then I'll use your public key that I got with VeriSign's signature on it to encrypt a little hello message to you. And if you are really Citibank, then you have the key on the other side, and you can read that secret, and you can send it back to me. And here's the key I want you to use to send it back to me. And the Citibank web server says, yes, okay, I really am Citibank. I have the secret key. I can decrypt your hello message. Now I will encrypt it using the key that you just gave me, and I'll send it back to you. And on that basis, we can conclude that we are in secure communication with one another, and you know that I am really Citibank. And so now you can send me a longer key, and we can use that to keep the conversation between us secret. And we didn't have to exchange any secrets ahead of the call because we set it all up as we went using the miracle of modern public key encryption. This is also the process used to take care of the relationship between you and PayPal, or you and your Bitcoin wallet, or you and your bank account, or you and your insurance company, or you and your medical provider. In other words, that structure of public key encryption allows a layer of secrecy, which then is used to give people trust or confidence in all sorts of interactions, and which can be layered one layer on top another in order to provide for confidence and trust in interactions, with one additional element. As you saw, we had a moment in that website of Citibank browser of depositor moment in which we had to depend upon an authoritative signature that says VeriSign says, or some other trusted party says, that this website is what it claims to be, that this is Citibank and not some 12-year-old in St. Petersburg. How do those signatures work? Well, if Ted and Alice want to exchange a message, and Ted wants to be sure that it's really Alice on the other side, they could reverse the process of public key encryption. Ted could say to Alice, Alice, will you please encrypt a message to me that says exactly such and such with your secret key? Because your secret key will be used to do encryption instead of decryption, I will be able to use your public key to decrypt what you sent me. If, on using your public key to decrypt a message, I receive back exactly what I told you to say, then I will know that I was talking to the person who was in control of Alice's secret key, because only Alice's secret key could have encrypted what her public key decrypted. So by reversing the use of the two keys, and this time encrypting with the secret key, Alice can prove to Ted that she was indeed the person who sent the message Ted received. This is a digital signature. And it's important for us to understand why, from the point of view of the mathematics, the principle of making a signature and the principle of keeping a secret are the same principle. That means that I can send you a message which is secret, not available to third parties to read, and I can prove to you that I sent it, that is by signing it, by using two encryption operations. First, I sign it by encrypting it with my secret key to the public key of the recipient intended. Next, I encrypt it. Next, I sign it by taking that encrypted text and encrypting it again with my secret key. Thus, when I send it to my intended recipient, the recipient first says, okay, let me find out whether this message was sent by the party who intended to send, whom I think I'm in communication with, and decrypts using the public key. What results is then a message, still unreadable, but the recipient says, okay, so let me run that across my secret key. If it can be decrypted, then it was sent to my public key, and I alone can read that message. That's very good. Now the parties have exchanged an authenticated secret message. More can be done to make that accessible to a group, but only to the members of the group by encrypting to multiple public keys and signing with the private key. All the various geometrical patterns that we might wish to make of secrecy can be achieved with just that one structure, a process that encrypts and also signs or encrypts, and which understands how to keep track of other people's secret keys. Such a working secrecy structure is the necessary root of all other systems of technical privacy. Good, now we have a way of understanding what we are, well, in need of learning, let us say. This is the source of the first technology project, Technology Project 1, which will be posted for next week's class along with the reading for next week's class, and which will allow you to begin using a free software tool used worldwide, GNU Privacy Guard, that comes out of the world of the Pretty Good Privacy movement started by my client Phil Zimmerman, who was willing to go to jail if necessary in the 1990s in the United States in order to bring strong encryption to ordinary people so that there would be privacy. But that we can talk about next time. Be well. Talk to you soon.